A podcast of the cinema.
What's your name?
I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
What you do?
And maybe you know me as the film reviews editor of The Wrap.
Or
maybe you know me as the co-host of the Who Shot Ya podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. Or as the co-host of Breakfast All Day, which used to be Who Shot Ya. Which used to be What the Flick.
Or.
So many questions.
Or.
Or from this program.
Or.
Or as the husband of Dave Weiss.
That's right.
That is pretty much what I'm known as.
When people talk about Alonzo Duraldi, they go, which one is he again? They go, that's right. He's Dave White's husband.
Yes.
That's what he is.
And who is this Dave White?
A star film critic for The Wrap. Who they said was too fat and beautiful to start his own athleisure line.
But are you?
But they, oh, they thought wrong. My spandex body suits are going to hug every voluptuous curve of my body.
Patterned with the face of Apichatpong Virasethakun.
Yes. And the princess from Boonmi.
Yes.
Yeah. Like a repeating, alternating pattern.
It's like an M.C. Escher of The Princess and the Fish.
I can't get enough of this Tommy Lahren situation.
Ugh.
We did discuss it on Linoleum Nights.
I don't even want to say her name out loud.
Oh, who cares?
It's like Candyman.
Whatever. Oh, but you do if you say it five times in a row.
She will angrily tweet at you.
You turn into a very itchy sports bra. So don't do that.
No, thank you.
We did already do this bit on Linoleum Nights.
Well, this is all airing out of order, so.
But it's all, well, who knows how it's
going
to air.
Well, this is going up today because it's our regular show and it's Sunday.
That's true.
And
everything's out of whack.
Yeah.
Alonzo leaves tomorrow. Monday, the 26th, for Italy.
It's true.
Venice, Europe. You'll be gone for 8 days.
The Biennale, darling.
8 days.
Yes.
My bed's going to be so cold.
Oh, in a good way, because it's summer. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, I deny you the opportunity to turn on the AC because I want to save money, but when I'm here alone, it's going
full tilt. Oh, yeah, you're going to be hanging meat in that bedroom. I know how it is.
But so what we've done this episode of Linoleum Knife and this week's episode of a normally Patreon-only podcast called Linoleum Nights, where we discuss anything we darn well please.
Yes.
And the next episode of another Patreon-only podcast called LKTV, which is a podcast of television.
Yes, it is.
And the next episode of Linoleum Knife and Fork.
Also a Patreon exclusive, normally.
A food podcast hosted by two film critics who like to eat. All of those shows are being sent out to the entire planet today.
This week.
This week. We did one yesterday. We did Linoleum Nights yesterday without a normal live experience.
Right. And with no cursing.
And with guests and no swearing, which is the feature, the big feature of it.
For many, that's why they even like Linoleum Nights. But no, we made a clean podcast so that it could go on our regular feed.
We played a new game called Cinephile with William Bibbiani and Gray Drake.
We did.
Ms. Movie Phone.
Mm-hmm.
The other two shows are not going to have guests.
No.
Because we're going to record those tomorrow morning before you get on that plane.
Yep.
And it is collectively known as the Summer Super Splash.
Or the Summer Splash Spectacular.
It's only called the Summer Super Splash.
It's the Summer Splash Spectacular by the person who actually is going to do the posting onto our feed. So just get used
to
that.
You're
going to
use the word spectacular. You better use the word super because that's what it is. The S is for super.
I'm not making it the Summer Super Splash Spectacular.
The U is for unique.
That's too much.
The P is for perfection. You know that we are freaks. I'll never get enough of also saying that explanation of the word super, because it's classic.
Yes.
It's iconic.
Yes.
I didn't invent it.
No.
It was gifted to me.
Yes.
Yeah. J.J. Fad.
Yes.
I love the Summer Super Splash because it gives people a taste for free. They don't even have to pay anything like a Patreon person does. They get to hear it all.
And maybe you'll think, wow, I need this in my inbox every week.
Right.
I need this to pop up magically in my podcatcher.
A daily amount of us.
And can I pay for it? Yes, I can. And I will.
I can tell you something. There's a special promotion going on right now.
Tell me more.
I'm going to tell you. Maybe you came to us in some other way besides having first listened to us guest on the late lamented Pop Rocket. Pop Rocket was a show on Maximum Fun Network.
Yep.
Hosted by Guy Branum, Winter Mitchell,
Rohrbaugh.
I don't know how to say her last name now.
Rohrbaugh.
She got married.
Yes.
Karen Tongson
and
Margaret Wobbler.
Yes. It was a show that we were fans of before we were ever on it.
And then somehow.
It was a show we were fans of and thought, we're never going to be cool enough to
be on
this
show. We're never
going
to be cool enough to be on this kind of show. Oh, and then suddenly, boom.
And then they asked us to be on it.
I don't know why.
Go figure.
But the... I guess we are cool enough.
I guess.
If you sit back and think about it, I guess we really are cool.
So Pop Rocket is no more, but Karen and Winter have gone on to create Waiting to Exhale, letter X, Hale.
Lovely.
A podcast for Gen Xers.
But here's the deal. Karen also wrote a book.
She did.
Karen is a professor at USC, and she wrote a book about Karen Carpenter. The name of this book is Why Karen Carpenter Matters. And it is part memoir, part explanation of Karen Carpenter, part queer
cultural
theory, part cultural studies. It's so many things in a little pocket-sized, book.
A handy tome.
Well, we have 5 copies. We may have more in a little later, but we have at least 5 copies.
Yes.
And the first 5 people to do the following are going to get a copy.
Signed by the author.
Signed by the author. Yes. Signed by Karen herself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's what you got to do. The first thing you got to do is decide if you have the budget in your life, and make sure you think this through thoughtfully.
Yes.
Because I'm the kind of person that looks at a new expenditure and thinks, what's in it for me?
Where's that going in the budget?
Yeah, where's that? How's that going to fit the budget? Don't jump on this offer all willy-nilly. I see a lot of you out there jumping into Patreon all fast and then being like, oh, I screwed up. The first of every month, I see it happen. Yes. Our number goes down by like 15 people on the first of every month. And then some come back. And look, some are like, yeah, no, I can't afford this.
We get it.
Also, they're not worth the money.
We understand.
Which also may be something you decide.
This is true. Maybe it's not a good fit.
Anyway, here's what the first 5 people to do the next thing get. You get a copy of this book, and here's what you got to do. Decide in your mind that you want to join Patreon at the $16 a month level. That's right. This is the $16 a month level.
Is 20 full right now?
20, I think, is full right now.
Okay.
20 is the only one. The $20 a month level is the top level, and it's the only level that
has a ceiling.
Has a ceiling of number of people, because more than 80 people, and I can't handle it.
Yeah,
because it involves sending out things.
Yes,
a lot of things. But $16 a month, what you get at $16 a month is everything that everybody else gets at the under that levels.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you get a prize, an LK prize of some sort. You're choosing.
And you get Linoleum Nights.
And then that's the level at which you get Linoleum Nights.
Right.
Which normally includes lots of profanity.
Yes, and a Facebook live stream.
And a Facebook live stream, yeah. So you can sit with us every Sunday morning while we do it and watch me sip tea in my body-conscious athleisure wear.
Whoever coined the word athleisure
is a genius and should win the Nobel Prize.
Should be trampled by water buffalo.
It's
the worst portmanteau ever.
Okay, so first you fix in your head, I want to pay these guys $16 a month. That's $4 a week.
Yes.
That's $1 per podcast per week. Yes. Honestly, is what it breaks down to.
Right.
50 cents per host. If you want to get real nitty gritty.
If you're just thinking about it, like you're tipping us.
Yeah, like tipping us. Anyway, decide you're going to do that. Decide you can do that. That you're made of money. Scrooge McDuck is your avatar.
Swimming in coins.
Yeah, just diving into a mountain of doubloons.
Triploons.
You want to pay $16 a month.
That's Daffy, not Scrooge.
And then the next thing you do before you sign up,
Don't
sign up just yet. Pay attention to these directions. Email me, dlelandwhite1964@gmail.com. That is D. Leland. Leland is my beautiful middle name. dlelandwhite1964@gmail.com. Tell me your intention. Because if more than five of you do this, I'm going to have to tell the sixth person, oh, wait, you're out of luck. Don't just go getting excited right now and spending your money. The books have run out.
So, wait, I'm confused.
The first five people to join, don't be confused, the first five people to join at 16 or upgrade to 16. I'm sorry, that was the thing I meant to say also. The first five people to join at 16 or upgrade to 16, you get Karen's book. I will mail it directly to you. She's going to sign them for me. This Tuesday, the 27th.
So you're going to tell unlucky person number six, sorry, we're out of books. And at that point, they can decide whether or not being a $16 member is worth it to them.
Right.
Okay, fine.
Yeah. If I tell you, if you're number six and I say, hey, sorry, we're out of books, you then haven't spent any money to upgrade or join.
Right.
I don't want to make this difficult or anything.
Sure. No, I understand.
But in order for this to happen, you have to pay attention to my directions and follow them to the letter. To the letter.
You want to see your book alive again.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's the deal. That's
take a picture holding up today's newspaper.
That's a Summer Super Splash Spectacular promotion.
Woo!
First five people to upgrade to 16 or join at 16 for the very first time.
Get a signed copy of Karen Tongson's Why
Karen Carpenter Matters. You want this book. It's a very good book.
Indeed.
And Karen is a delight as a person.
Yes. If you haven't listened to Waiting to Exhale yet, go check it out.
You should. One of the smartest people I've ever met in my life.
Yeah.
Says things I've never thought of before. And I go, oh, I'm going to pretend I thought of that too.
I want to give a quick shout out to other podcasts while we're sort of on that topic.
Yeah.
First of all, the High Camp podcast, relatively new one.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Rucker, who's very funny.
We're going to get to the movies in a minute.
We are, I swear. Brian Rucker, who's very funny and quite smart, picked up an old book that I remember from the 90s called High Camp. It was actually a two-volume series, as it turned out. From
Time Life.
Yes, exactly. No, an older gay librarian in the Midwest somewhere wrote this book.
That's cool.
Kind of using the same principle that I had behind 101 Must-See Movies for Gay Men, which was, oh, these kids today, they don't understand their heritage. And so
children don't know.
Exactly. We have to teach
the children.
Teach the children. So he wrote this two-volume book called High Camp about movies that were important to the homosexual experience.
Right.
And his definition of camp is way off of what you might be thinking. It's not strictly the Susan Sontagian kind of thing. Okay. He basically makes
By the way, is not the only way to talk about certainly this not. Subject anyway.
But his
We've come to that, you know.
His notion is anything that is of interest to gay people. So, like, you know, Paris is Burning and you know, the boys in the band and the killing of Sister George all fall under that umbrella. So, anyway, Brian on this podcast is making it his goal to try and get through all, like, 400 and something movies that are in these books. Good luck with that. But he had me on to talk about one of my favorite topics on Earth, the 1967 Valley of the Dolls, which you and I have done a commentary track for. And if you are a Patreon member at certain levels, you do get access to our commentary tracks, and that is one of them. But Brian and I talk about it. The day we recorded, I think, was actually the 50th anniversary of Sharon Tate's death. Mm. So we talked about, you know, her and, you know, obviously the new Tarantino movie and various other topics. It was an interesting discussion. I could have talked to him for a whole other hour because, you know, you get me wound up on Valley and I can just go. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, so check that episode out and check out his podcast. It's a fun podcast. I'm enjoying it. And also there's a show called Christmas Book Review. A woman named Carrie Mercer hosts, and it is exactly what it sounds like. She reviews books about Christmas, and she throws a very wide net. She will review like children's picture books and nonfiction.
Sorry,
and
I just banged the table with my iced tea picture.
Yes, knock it off. And, you know, cookbooks and, you know, holiday, you know, craft guides, whatever. Like, she, if it's about Christmas, she will talk about it. And so when she started the show, I said, oh, hey, have I got a Christmas book for you?
It's mine. I wrote it.
Mine. yes, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. And on this latest episode, she reviews it. And it's one of the best reviews I've ever gotten, not just in terms of how much she enjoyed the book, but in terms of how much she gets what I was going for in writing it in the first place.
Right.
I was really touched and, you know, impressed with how she was able to sort of boil it down to its essence and sort of really go into the notion of what is a Christmas movie and how do we respond to these films and what can fall under that umbrella. I thought she did a great job. So if you are, like me, obsessed with Christmas and want to find out about other books that, you know, you might be interested in and you know, that have different, you know, angles on the season, Carrie is out there doing the work and reading these books. So check out the Christmas Book Review podcast.
Now that we've promoted ourselves
to an unbearable degree,
I saw Ready or Not.
Yes,
you came back from the screening. It was a few weeks ago now.
Yeah, they screened it kind of.
They showed it to you early.
Yeah,
and for whatever reason, I just couldn't get over the mental hump of going to the Fox lot with you.
Which, why that Fox lot in particular? It's not like it's a super long drive.
I know, but I just had this idea of like, the Fox lot, not today.
Not I have to me. Take my driver's license out of my wallet and show it to the guard.
Park and walk across the lot. And, you know.
Oh, you are jaded.
You know, every
people come to this city and like would clamor to get to walk across the Fox lot.
Just unencumbered.
Yes.
Not even on a tour.
Exactly. It's like, about. Look, Nakatomi Plaza, you know.
Right. No, I know. I know. Listen, I've lived here 20 years. I've been going to that studio lot for 20 years.
Yes.
It's just a place I go for work.
I know. Hey, look, I used to temp on that lot.
But I will say, every time I go, I do try to stop and look, like, I walk past a soundstage, and I stop and look at one of the plaques. Because on every soundstage, there's a plaque next to the door. And that plaque has a list. It's a big engraved plaque.
Yeah.
There's a list of all the classic films that were shot there.
And TV shows.
And so that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Like, you walk past that, and you think, oh, that is really rad. You know, like,
don't you like seeing the book thief book drop little house they have?
Yes. Because at Fox, even something sad and weird just gets to stay.
Well, they always had this thing that was like a drop off a book, pick up a book.
Yeah.
In this little birdhousey kind of thing that's shaped like
one of those free libraries that people put on their corners.
But the thing that the books are in is shaped like the original building on the Fox lot, like the original office building that they had there. So it's this cool little architectural thing. And then they themed it to that movie, The Book Thief, a few years ago, which no one cared about. But it's
because it was a bad film.
Because it was a bad film. But the Book Thief sign is still there. So. And look, the whole thing is owned by Disney now anyway, so we have to enjoy it while it's there, because who knows what they'll do.
Right, exactly. You know, they have cats that wander around the lot.
Yes. Which
they're the only lot I ever see that has cats wandering around.
That I've seen with my own eyes, yeah. I mean, I've heard about, like, there being other ones, but yeah. I mean, because, like, you know, Universal's got those trams going through all the time. Who wants to deal with that?
Right, and so does Warner Brothers, which probably scares the cats away.
True,
yeah. But you know, you walk past the soundstage at Warner Brothers, and you look at the plaque, and it says Casablanca.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah,
and
you're
like, oh, my God.
The Petrified Forest. It's insane. It's been there forever.
You know, when I stop and think, or when you scold me while we're sitting here on the mic, I think, yeah, that is pretty rad.
Look, like, I hate driving out
to
the...
I think it was unusually warm that day.
Okay,
and I
sure.
thought, I'll just be sweating. I'll just be sweating when I go from the car to the store.
It's a pain. It's a pain to go to the Sony lot because it's out in Culver City, which is its own crazy labyrinth.
Right.
But once
I... parking is the most insane.
Oh, the worst. But once I'm there, I'm like, oh, yeah, this was the MGM lot after all. And the buildings are named for, like, Irving Thalberg or whatever. Judy Garland.
Judy
exactly.
wandered those blocks of the MGM lot.
In a haze.
You don't know that.
Not all the time.
Not all the time.
Sometimes, though, probably.
Leave her alone.
Look, I got nothing but respect.
You leave that woman nothing alone. She's a saint.
Nothing but respect for my president, Judy Garland. So, ready or not?
Now, I saw it opening morning at the Arclight. I got a shout out to my friend Steve, who came to the movie with me. And he showed up that morning, and he goes, hey, what are we seeing? Like, I told him the day before.
Uh-huh.
He goes, what are we seeing? I said, Ready or Not. He goes, oh, I saw that last night. I'm just staring at him like, seriously? Like, I texted you and said, we're going to see Ready or Not. He said, yeah, I got bored, wanted to see a movie. And I forgot what you said, so I just went to that. I was like, do you want to go again? He's like, yeah, let's go again.
You know what?
He was happy to go again.
I would right, see cool. it again. Maybe not 2 days in a row, but I would like to see it again.
Less than 24 hours later.
Yes.
That is the very first time I've ever had a friend be like, what are we going to see? Oh, yeah, I watched that already yesterday. That's never happened. So I got that is shout out worthy.
That's a new one.
And
he was entertained
and
again?
He's a trooper. Yeah, he just was like, I'll do whatever. I don't care. He's great. Okay, so anyway. I don't know what other theater they're doing this with. Like, how many other theaters nationwide are getting this? But when I saw it, they have attached a little 5-minute short film.
Huh. I did not get that.
Called So Torn, S-E-W.
Okay.
And it's about a mobile seamstress in a very, very cool little vintage car who happens upon a gruesome motorcycle accident in which... The two motorcyclists who have crashed into each other, one is handcuffed and one has a gun, and they're both out of reach, and both of these men are injured and cannot get to the gun. But it's clear that one of them gets to the gun.
Wait, is one handcuffed to the other one, or is
no? One is handcuffed, and the handcuff has broken.
I see.
Yeah. And so, she doesn't know what's going on, but she spends the next 3 minutes doing something that will change everyone's life. It is a very, very cool short film. It's called So, S-E-W, Torn. I don't know, what theaters are playing this short film with Ready or Not, but if you are near one and you know about this, go to that one. Because it's a fun 5 minutes, and it's about 5 minutes, maybe six tops.
I mean, it might just be in New York and L.A. for, like, Oscar qualification, but I have no idea.
Look, if I were in the Academy, I'd vote for it right now. It's that much of a fun little punch
right.
of a thing. Which is a perfect amuse-bouche. For Ready or Not, which is its own delightful punch.
Yes.
Of a film. These August movies, sometimes they will take you by surprise. Because they release these August movies with the thought, eh, who cares?
They really generally do. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't care. They don't care. And this one, I would say the most famous person in it is Adam Brody or Andy McDowell. One of that's a toss-up, right?
Yeah, I mean, Henry Cherney is a well-known character actor and, you know,
yeah,
big in Canada.
Right. But it's about a young woman, played by Samara Weaving, mm-hmm. who is the daughter of Hugo Weaving.
Yes.
She's getting married. She's marrying into an extremely rich family, like staggeringly wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
They have a giant mansion that has, like, secret servants' corridors and things like that. And she gets married, and you can tell from the get-go that this family is full of terrible people.
Yes, and to the extent that, like, even her boyfriend was like,
do you want out?
We don't have to get married. We don't have to do this. Yeah, literally, she's got the dress on, and minutes before the ceremony, he's offering her the opportunity to escape. But no, she wants to be married to him.
They go through with it, and...
The family has made its money mostly on some very popular board games.
Right.
But also, it turns out, they own a couple of NFL teams and, you know.
Yeah, they own a lot of things.
A lot of things that involve...
Industries.
You know, industries, but a lot that involves games and playing and games of chance and that kind of thing.
So the family tradition is on a wedding day, the person marrying into the family must pick a card. And the card will tell you what game you are going to play with the family. And it can be any kind of game.
Yahtzee, tiddlywinks.
Right. However, there is one card you don't want to pick.
Yeah.
And only gets picked by chance every few decades. And that card is the game Hide and Seek. And if you choose Hide and Seek, you then become the person who... You're it.
Yeah.
And you have to hide while the family tries to hunt you down and murder you.
Yes. This is not explained to her at the outset, but she discovers along the way that, yes, to be caught is to be killed. And the family has its reasons for this.
Reasons that we can't really explain without giving away a really crazy and fun and ridiculous third act situation.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know...
So we won't.
Whether or not you take it seriously, the family is taking this very seriously.
Yeah. And then she has to be chased, and then she has to outsmart... What's the survivor
Outwit, outsmart, outlast.
Yeah, she has to do all...
No, that can't be right.
Three of those things.
Anyway, something outlast.
And she comes up against some increasingly ridiculous and horrifying... situations, including a bin in the goat barn where they keep the corpses.
Yeah. And mind you, she's doing all of this in a wedding dress. Yeah. Like, she does rip off some of the bottom of the skirt and she exchanges her heels for a pair of high top sneakers. But yeah, she's still running around in a wedding dress while these people are coming after her.
So I don't want to give you any more plot.
Yeah.
But I do want to say that... it's quite funny.
Yes. It's darkly funny.
It's gory. So understand that.
Yeah.
And it is a lot smarter than you would think it would be about class issues and how demented very, very, very rich people are, like, across the board through life.
Yes.
One thing that is in the trailer, I think we can talk about it. Maids in the house.
Yes.
Find themselves accidentally killed in the process of the game. And one of the punchlines of that is one of the women who accidentally kills a maid immediately makes it personal about herself and says, "Why does this always happen to me?"
Yeah, this is a movie about rapacity.
Yeah. And so it's about this horrifyingly bad family who are meant to stand in for all of the horrifyingly bad people who do terrible things in the world and make the world the worst place, such as David Koch, who just died this week.
Yes.
And so as a comedy, as a thriller, as a nasty, gory movie, as a satire about, you know, class war, I just had a wonderful time.
Yeah, when I reviewed it, I said that at its best, it reminded me of some of the best stuff in Sleuth, The Last of Sheila, and The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, totally.
I have to admit, like, this is one of those movies where I like it so much that I wish I loved it. Like, it does so many things so well. There are a few things I wish it did better. Like,
all right.
I think, like, for example, the production design of the mansion,
yes,
as cool as it is,
right,
I think they could have really played on the whole antique toy thing more often than they do.
Yeah.
There's a few places where they do. Like, when she has to go hide, they play this old The Hide and Seek song record on the Victrola, which is
right,
this weirdly creepy little,
right,
you know, ditty. I'm thinking about a movie like Sleuth, where, have you seen the original with Olivier and Michael Caine?
You know, I don't think I have.
Oh, man, okay. I think it's one of the last Joseph Mankiewicz movies.
Mm-hmm.
Olivier's house has like old toys and old puppets and all this stuff like everywhere,
right,
you know, and it's so, and he's a mystery writer, and it so much kind of ties into his love of puzzles and games and, you know, da da da. And because they're using that as a starting point for this family and what they do and how they've done it, you do get these shots of like these sort of like cabinets with all the old versions of the board games in them over the years,
right,
and stuff.
And then they don't employ them in any way.
And then they don't employ them in any way.
Yeah.
And I would have liked them to go a little further. But again, this is a thing where it's a movie that I think is really terrific, and it could have gone a little further and been like great. But yeah, it absolutely entertaining and smart and wicked. And I had a great time, and I would totally watch it again.
Stuff you don't see coming.
For sure.
I can think of at least two things that I did not see coming.
Okay, cool.
And I...
And Samara Weaving is a champ.
Oh, yeah.
I have never seen her in anything before, but
she's
like...
She's giving every final girl,
yeah,
that you ever wanted.
She does look a lot like Margot Robbie, but, you know...
She really... Oh, you're right. I hadn't thought about that.
I hadn't thought about it either, but when I posted my review on Facebook and I had the poster, and everybody was like, wait, that's not Margot Robbie? But, you know, she's also Australian.
Are all Australians... Do they look like Margot Robbie?
Does Kylie Minogue look like Margot
Robbie?
Every
woman in Australia looks like Margot Robbie?
Yes, all of them. Judy Davis. Wendy Hughes.
My mind's blown now.
They all look like Margot Robbie.
Okay, so then we watched Vita and Virginia.
Yes. Crumpets.
You are Vita, and I am Virginia. How about that? I think that's right.
In that you're the lunatic, but also the more talented? I'll take it.
Enigmatic and poetic is where I was really going with this. You're popular and modern and bouncy. Devil May Care. Bohemian.
I'm the shallow, privileged one, and you're the real artist.
Let's just cut to the chase and say yes. But that's what that means.
Look, I've always wanted to be Gemma Arterton, so, you know, I'll take it.
We watched this.
Elizabeth Debicki, another Australian who does not look like Margot Robbie.
Oh, you're right. She doesn't. She looks just like Elizabeth Debicki, though.
She does. And yeah, she does not look the slightest like Nicole Kidman, another Australian, as Virginia Woolf in The Hours.
Who is also tall.
Yes.
Are all Australian women tall?
All of them, Dave. Kylie Minogue. Statuesque.
4'8", I know.
Danny Minogue.
I remember seeing the Fever album cover for the first time and thinking, oh, wow, look how long Kylie's legs are. And then I thought, and then I went and hunted down, how tall is she? And I was like, oh, her legs are not long at all. She is.
Trick photography.
A tiny little person.
Yes. You've been in a room with her.
Well, I have now.
Yes.
But that was well before.
Gotcha.
Don't everybody get excited. I was in a room with her because she was on a TV show that I got free tickets to see. She was taping a show that I got free tickets to go see.
Yes.
But she was standing 10 feet away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh my God, Kylie. Oh God, Kylie. Anyway,
how many large gay men has she reduced to quivering jelly? Kylie,
more than me.
No, you're not the only one.
I'm not the only. No, but I'm the best.
Well, sure,
I'm the best one. The best Kylie fan. Over 300 pounds. I'm the best Kylie fan over 300 pounds.
Someone's going to step up to you. Be careful.
Where was I going?
Vita and Virginia.
Vita and Virginia. It is the love story of Vita Sackville-West.
Yes.
And Virginia Woolf.
Yes.
It stars Gemma Arterton and Elizabeth Debicki.
It does.
Gemma Arterton is Vita.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth Debicki is Virginia. Not wearing a nose.
No.
Decided she didn't feel like it.
She's going to look like Elizabeth Debicki.
Yeah. Yeah, you go back and look at pictures of both of these women, and you're like, okay, this is... We're just having to guess.
Yeah.
Like, they both need to have name tags on. It says, hi, I'm Vita. Hi, I'm Virginia. You put them face to face next to the actual photos of real life people.
This is the, like, hot lesbian fantasy version of what these two look like.
Oh, is it? It's my favorite kind of hot lesbian fantasy. I'll tell you why.
Hats.
That's number one. Thank you. Hats. Outfits.
Yes.
Coats.
Driving coats.
Gloves. Shoes.
Cigarette holders.
Trays of little cakes. Lamps. Cushions. Sofas. Manners.
Telegrams.
Yes. Wooden furniture.
Like newspapers. Train carriages.
I could live in a film like this.
Oh, the cars. Just the cars. Cars.
Yeah. First of all, it's the 20s.
Yeah.
All the literary bohemians are out giving each other syphilis. I did ask in the middle of the film, I turned to him and I said, when did they make penicillin for the first time? Because I think it matters here.
It's relevant to the plot.
And these two are just... verbally talking. Eileen Atkins.
Verbally talking.
Those words just fell right out of my mouth. Yeah. And I don't think we're going to edit them out, even though normally I would make him stop and do just that.
There's a lot of verbal talking.
There's a lot of verbal talking. I'm sorry. Now I feel like an idiot, but I'm going to soldier on.
Yes, press on.
All right.
Play through.
Eileen Atkins took Virginia Woolf's letters, turned this into a play.
It was a play first. Yes.
And
Eileen Atkins, who, by the way, if you have not watched Tea with the Dames yet, you are missing out.
Oh, can I just re-quote my favorite part of Tea with the Dames?
I wish you would.
Eileen Atkins is talking about how she never thought she was pretty enough to play
Cleopatra.
And Maggie Smith looks at her and says, and how are we to respond to that? Oh, no, Eileen, you're so beautiful. Such a beauty. And then Judi Dench says, they wanted me to play Cleopatra. And I said, well, I'll do it if you want Cleopatra to be a menopausal dwarf.
And that's how I played it.
And Eileen Atkins says, and that's what she was. And Judi Dench says, and that's how I played it.
True, I forgot the middle line.
So anyway, Eileen Atkins took the letters, wrote the play, wrote the screenplay for this film.
Yeah,
and it's directed by Shania Button.
Yes,
so I don't really know.
I don't either. I'm gonna guess. Lots of British television.
Perhaps.
But I don't know.
And much of the film is them saying things that are in the letters.
At the camera.
Letters from Vita to Virginia. Letters from Virginia to Vita. Standing in front of the camera, looking directly into the camera. and reciting the letters to each other like this.
Yes.
My dearest friend, we shall be together.
I ache at the thought that I have that I have provided you even the smallest bit of pain.
Oh. Oh, Vita. Oh, Virginia. And it just goes on like that.
Yeah.
It's the best. It moves so slowly, you'll think you're napping. You might nap.
Yeah, this is maybe the first movie since Cemetery of Splendor where if you do nap, you doze off. It's fine.
It doesn't matter.
It's part of the experience.
They're still going to be talking when you come back too.
And maybe in a new outfit.
It is perhaps wrong to love this film, but I love this film.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that you could say were wrong with it. But
and if you love the things I love and you know what you love and why you love it, you're also going to love it.
Yeah, especially if you're one of those people like a dear friend of ours who goes to period movies to analyze the outfits and see what's period and what's not.
Well, analyze the costumes and determine what they have used that was actual vintage.
Right, and what a recreation.
I would love for her to see it. And because she will point at the frame and be like, that's real, that's not, that's real, that's not. That was made, that's impossible to have. They made that for the film.
That would have been too heavy to wear.
And watch her, listen to her complain about actresses, modern actresses, who are too vain to wear vintage because it requires like corsets because the clothes themselves are so thick and heavy and padded.
Right.
She'll go off. It's great.
It is that kind of movie. But if you're down for that kind of movie and you want to see two actresses who I'm a huge fan of,
I love them both. I'll watch anything they're in.
Say very smart things and pitch mad woo at each other. Then you know
we are huge Gemma Arterton fans in this house.
Their finest, y'all.
Their finest. Did you hear us? You know, go on and on and on about that. In what was that? 2017?
When probably.
That
came out? Yeah.
If you didn't. Go watch.
Track it down.
Their finest. It's lovely.
Oh, so good.
Anyway, Vita and Virginia.
Yes.
Do watch it.
Pray. Pray do.
The opposite of Virginia. Virginia. Alonso. If a really stupid angel falls in the forest and no one is around to hear it explode, did it happen?
I wish that were the plot of Angel Has Fallen.
Please discuss the plot. I gave the plots of Ready or Not and Vita and Virginia.
Okay, sure. It's your turn. I'll tackle this one. Yeah. As I've been saying, this is our ongoing punishment for not making White House Down a hit. I hope you're all ashamed of yourself because you didn't go see White House Down. We're now at the third Gerard Butler as an American Secret Service agent movie.
He's kind of American.
Kind of ish. So in the first movie, in Olympus Has Fallen, he manages to save the White House from terrorists. In London Has Fallen, he manages to save the president during the G8 summit or something. I forget.
Actually, who cares?
Who cares?
Right.
Exactly. This movie, it's basically The Fugitive because he is set up to take a fall and must clear his name and stay one step ahead of the authorities and the bad guys, all of whom are trying to kill him. Here's a tip, filmmakers.
They're all waiting for you to give them the tip.
If you want the audience to have even the slightest bit of surprise or uncertainty about who the villains of your film are,
right?
Maybe don't cast Danny Houston and Tim Blake Nelson. Because when you cast Danny Houston and Tim Blake Nelson, the second they appear on screen, a four-year-old child who has been dragged there by their parents who didn't want to get a sitter is going, oh, well, that's the bad guy then. Like, it was a twist in Children of Men when Danny Houston wasn't the villain.
I did not see Danny Houston not coming.
Exactly. I, you know, the moment that he's in a room with Clive Owen, I'm like, oh, something terrible is going to happen because it's Danny Houston. Right. No, that's the shockeroo.
Yeah.
Danny Houston was not playing the villain, but that's the exception. So
they ever remake The Seventh Seal, he just plays death.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's bad news. So, yeah, this is that kind of movie where they just make it super obvious from the get-go who the bad guy is. And then Morgan Freeman is the president.
Yes.
Which he's been working up to over the last two movies.
Past two films. He's earned his way into the top
spot. Yes. Somehow we got rid of President Aaron Eckhart and we have moved on.
Thank God.
To President Morgan Freeman. Although playing a guy, and he's been named this back since Olympus Has Fallen, so it can't have been intentional, but President Trumbull.
That's completely...
just a weird coincidence.
Just a weird coincidence, yeah.
Yeah, figure. Anyway, this movie is inane and terrible, and yet the best of the three has fallen movies, mainly because... Nick Nolte pops up as Gerard Butler's dad.
Right.
Take that in for a moment.
Yeah.
And,
which you buy.
Yeah. No, it works.
Remember when Nick Nolte was a model?
Oh, God. Nick Nolte was a dish.
Early 1970s, he was a model.
And there's a picture.
Before he was ever even an actor.
They show you a picture of him as a young person in this movie. Yeah. And you're like, oh, yeah, God, hot Nick Nolte. I mean, as late as 1992, he was people's sexiest man alive.
I remember.
You know, and like, he was getting a little craggy, but look, Prince of Tides Nick Nolte, still Barry handsome. I was reminded of All About Eve when Margot Channing finds out that when she was stuck in a car on a long weekend that Eve, her understudy, went on in her place and blew everybody away.
Right.
And she says, it's something along the lines of like, comes in out of nowhere and gives a performance. And I'm watching this dumb movie with people just sort of like bumbling their way through it. And, you know, Piper Perabo is the devoted nurse who is married to Gerard Butler.
Give a big coyote welcome.
Exactly.
Welcome.
Give a big coyote ugly welcome.
Give a big coyote welcome to Piper Perabo.
But then Nick Nolte shows up and gives a performance. Yeah. And I was like, okay, movie, you're engaging me now. And then he's off screen again for a lot of the movie, and it's back to being stupid. Nick Nolte like is the one saving grace of this thing. Otherwise, it is just the same nonsense as always, and with cheesy special effects,
very bad special effects.
I don't have the keenest eye for this sort of thing. Like we have friends in the industry who are very good at picking out like stuff.
Yeah,
but I can always tell fireballs.
Oh, yeah.
If you are trying to fireball a building and that building is still standing, you better really bring your A game, because otherwise it's going to look like garbage. And it does in this movie.
Right. All right. I need to discuss something very important.
Okay.
My trash movie boyfriend, Gerard Butler.
That's a problematic relationship.
Did you know that he is not a bad actor?
I don't know that.
Did you know that he was in a Shakespeare movie once?
Yes, he was.
And he said Shakespeare words.
He was good that one time.
He was pretty good at it.
In that Coriolanus movie. But like, is that his Punch Drunk Love? Like, what do we take away from that?
Is he the Adam Sandler of this?
Yes. Of garbage action movies.
Oh, God. Listen.
I mean, doesn't that just mean he could be acting if he felt like it, but clearly doesn't?
Here's, in my imagination, Gerard Butler is this guy. Oh, wow. They want me to be in a movie.
They're going to pay me how much?
They're going to do, I get what? I get help? I get paid what? Oh, sign me up. Yeah, okay. I'll be in a movie. You don't have to ask me twice. Oh, I have to sound like an American? Yeah, sure, whatever. I'll try. Maybe I won't.
Every so often.
Yeah. And then that was what he And then it was successful. Like, he just decided, like, oh, I'll just keep doing this. And people kept hiring him to be in things. And then he was in the I'm the Bad Soccer Dad movie.
Yes.
And then...
Bad Dad Soccer Dad, as they call it on Flophouse.
I forget the name of the movie. But he was the soccer dad.
It had the same name as a movie that had come out before of it. I can't remember either.
Like, it's called something like... Playing for Keeps.
Playing for Keeps. That is what it's called. Yes. Okay. That is what it's called.
I know we reviewed it on this show. Yes. Don't ask me to remember.
He was in The Ugly Truth.
Listen, all I can do is gaze lovingly at my trash movie boyfriend. I can't be bothered even trying to figure out.
Even when he is the Phantom of the Opera.
Especially when he's singing songs from Phantom of the Opera.
Now, is he
the music of the night?
Are you still into him though? Like on a purely shallow looks basis? Because in this movie, he has turned into like current Sylvester Stallone. Like Sylvester Stallone in the last Blood trailer has the same countenance as Gerard Butler now. I don't know what the route to get there is, but they both took it.
I'm gonna tell you something. My poor trash movie boyfriend's face continuity in this film is a bit of a mess. Because there are moments where he looks like he rested the night before. And then there are moments when it looks like he went to Soho House. Hung out with other celebrities.
Until the wee hours.
Until early in the morning. Like, and you never know which scene, like, because obviously... films are shot out of continuity.
Right.
So you never know which face you're going to get. You're going to get he looks good. Like, this was a good day on set. Like, he was awake and alert and everything. And then the other day, he looks hungover in some scenes.
Allegedly.
I don't know if he was ever hungover.
Yes.
I do know once, though, that Grey Drake ran into him at Soho House.
Yes.
And when she turned her back to talk to someone else for a moment and then turned back around... Kylie Minogue was standing there talking to Gerard Butler.
It all comes back to Kylie.
It always does.
And she did not look like Margot Robbie, and she was not as tall as Elizabeth Debicki.
She wasn't as tall as the bar.
In heels.
All I'm saying is that my dude sometimes looks like he's had a good night and sometimes looks like he's had a rough night. And I love both of him.
All right.
Both versions.
Okay.
When he looks healthy, I think, come here, Gerard Butler. You're my trash movie boyfriend. When he looks unhealthy, I think, oh, poor Gerard Butler.
Let me pour you a tomato juice.
Let me give you a cup of tea, my trash movie boyfriend. That's all. I have no critical faculties that I feel I should use on him. Because when I see an actor like this running the game, which is what he's doing,
mm-hmm.
works all the time, does whatever he pleases.
Hunty killy.
Feels like he doesn't lift a finger. and every movie he's in is the barf of puke. So that now if I see that he's in a film, I think, oh, good.
He didn't try, so I don't have to either.
Yeah, like, I don't feel like I should have to be a film critic when I'm watching his movie.
Because he didn't bother to be an actor.
Yeah, I'm just... We have... He and
be
I
like
have
Gerard, you just show up.
Yeah, and... I have an understanding. This is a terrible film.
Awful.
And yet, so are the other two.
Yes, it's still the best of the three, but yet, you still shouldn't bother.
I'm into all of them. They're worthless. I like it.
Like, I don't even remember if Piper Perabo was the wife in the previous ones or not.
I have such vague
memories of them because they're such garbage films. I just flush them out of my brain.
The role of the wife in these films is always, just come home to me. They're on the phone. It's like the Amy
Honey?
Schumer sketch.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just come home to me. At least half not blown up.
Right.
Yeah.
That's all I ask.
Like, you could lose an arm. Just come home to me.
Yes.
That's all.
Is that it? Is that all we saw this week? Vision Portraits.
You saw Vision Portraits.
Yes.
I have not yet seen Vision Portraits.
You will catch up with it, I know.
But we have a screening link, and I'm going to watch. Listen, I've got plenty of work to do while you're gone, but I also have a lot of films to watch while you're gone to Italy.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool streaming stuff that we need to catch up on. Jawline on Hulu, American Factory, and The Great Hack on Netflix, I'm hearing good things about. But yeah, Vision Portraits is a documentary that we screened at Outfest this summer. I was fortunate enough to do the Q&A with the film's director, Rodney Evans. And he is a talented filmmaker who is probably best known for a film called Brother to Brother, which is a queer film about the Harlem Renaissance and featured probably the first major screen role for Anthony Mackie. And so Evans for the last few years has been dealing with retinitis pigmentosa, and he is slowly losing his eyesight. And so he set out to make this documentary about not just sort of his own issues with losing his eyesight as a filmmaker, but he talked to other artists and other media who are either partially or completely blind and how they have continued to be creative. So he interviews a photographer, a writer, and a dancer choreographer. And they all have their own sort of unique perspectives about how they are able to continue to be creative even without their vision. And you know, Evans takes the opportunity to sort of let us follow along on, you know, what's happening with him and how he's coping with just sort of the day-to-day of all this stuff. It's a really beautiful film. It's really inspirational. And I just think, you know, it's a smart movie about something that would seem to be insurmountable, but at least with these four people, you know, has not been. So that's pretty amazing. It's currently showing in Los Angeles at the Lumbly Royal. It has dates coming up at the in San Francisco, in D.C., in Chicago, and Philadelphia. I think RodneyEvansFilm.com is the website where they list, you know, dates and scheduling and whatnot. If you get a chance to see this movie, I really highly recommend it. I've always been a fan of Evans's work. Definitely, you know, Brother to Brother, and also his film The Happy Sad. But this is just a really fascinating, you know, very personal kind of first-person documentary.
Got a DVD pick this week?
I do. And I did not mean to connect these two things, but I guess I am.
That's
Derek Jarman's Derek Jarman's final film, Blue, which he made after completely losing his eyesight because of HIV-related complications. It is basically a soundscape that it plays out over a solid blue screen. And that soundscape includes Jarman. It includes his longtime muse, Tilda Swinton, other actors who worked in several of his films. I think Nigel Terry is one of the voices you hear. And, of course, a music created by Simon Fisher-Turner, who scored most of Jarman's feature films. I got to talk about Blue last year when they did a Jarman retrospective on R.I.P. Filmstruck. But Kino Lorber is putting out a new 4K restoration Blu-ray with a lot of extras and cool stuff. Also putting out a 2K restoration of Jarman's The Garden this week. Both discs coming with a lot of information. If you are a fan of Derek Jarman, this is stuff you're going to want to have in your collection.
Roadhouse.
That, I thought you were... Okay, fine.
I was going to do Get Out Your Handkerchiefs.
Yeah.
Because it was one of the very first foreign language films I ever saw in my life on HBO when I was a kid. I was so excited because it had subtitles.
Right.
It was from France. Yeah. And I remember watching it not thinking really that there was any sort of like anything unusual or weird about it. And as I did my research, we just got the Blu-ray sent to the house.
Yeah.
And I was like, ooh, I haven't seen this since 80, 81.
I saw it
on HBO.
I saw it the summer between my junior and senior year of high school, and
came
I
out
felt very, very sophisticated.
Yeah, it came out in 1978.
Yeah, won the Best Foreign Film Oscar.
Yeah. I started reading the synopsis to just refresh my memory about what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my.
Yeah, oh, no, it's crazy.
And I thought, do I recommend this without rewatching it? And then I thought, nope.
You're right. We should probably take a look at it.
Yeah. Before I decide if I recommend it.
But I'll tell you, speaking of young Nick Nolte,
it led me
70s
down
Gerard Depardieu.
Well, yeah. It led me down a rabbit hole of what was going on in the 70s? Because I was just a child.
Right.
So were you.
Yeah.
But holy cow. Everyone was getting busy. Like,
it was the fallout from the sexual revolution.
It really was.
Yeah.
So...
which would come to a grinding halt in the early 80s.
I'm gonna watch it again, and then I'll decide if I want to re-recommend.
Fair enough.
You know, because you have these fond memories of these things that you watched as a kid, and you're thinking, you know, oh, what a cool movie that was. It was actually just, oh, it was just the first thing you ever watched with subtitles, right. And now you're
appalled by
and
it.
Now you're kind of appalled by it.
Yeah, no, we saw Going Places a few years ago,
which is also
bananas.
Appalling moments.
Yeah.
Roadhouse obviously has no appalling.
Oh, moments. No, none.
We watched it last night for our Linoleum Knife Club meeting.
Yes.
That is a Patreon
benefit.
Benefit at a certain level. If it's the $16 level you're seeking to get that free book, the LK Club meeting is something you'll enjoy.
That's
once
right.
A month.
You will.
We all watch a movie together and we chat on Google Hangout while the film is going. Not on camera, but, you know, typing.
In the Google Hangout chat. Mm-hmm.
And Patrick Swayze is a very famous bouncer in this film, and he goes to bounce people at a new bouncy house called the Double Deuce. And he falls in love with a sexy doctor played by Kelly Lynch.
Yes, who's giving Nicolette Sheridan realness.
Sam Elliott plays his mentor.
Yes.
His bouncer mentor. Also a famous bouncer.
Yes.
In this universe...
there are famous bouncers.
There are famous bouncers who run the show.
Oh, yeah.
At whatever venue they work at. And he comes... Patrick Swayze runs afoul of a unscrupulous and evil, a wicked, wicked man who's a real estate developer.
Small-town magnate.
Going to bring a JCPenney to that small town.
Played by Ben Gazzara.
Wearing a villain's hat throughout.
And an ascot. And he's named Brad. Like, they just load it all up.
But I'll tell you, Patrick Swayze is wearing something more powerful than a villain's hat and an ascot. He is wearing... pleated trousers
and a coral shirt
and blousy shirts from the International Mail Catalog.
Yeah, there's one that we never get a full body shot. I'm like, is he wearing a gi or is it just like a very complicated shirt? It's like a double breasted.
Diane von Furstenberg
wrap
shirt for men.
I guess
what it looks
so.
Like.
Yeah.
I determined while watching this film for the nth time.
Oh, God. It was my second and hopefully final viewing.
How many times have I seen Roadhouse? And how many more times will I watch Roadhouse? Who can say? I realized that by wearing loose-fitting clothing,
mm-hmm.
lots of pleats, lots of fluffiness in the shirts,
uh-huh.
extended range of kicking motion.
I suppose
that's
so.
That's how he won all the fights.
I guess so. But he does wear skinny jeans for Tai Chi.
This is a movie about fighting, bad guys.
Yes.
It's about fighting your friends. It's about fighting strangers.
Yes.
It's about fighting drunk people in bars.
Blowing up auto parts stores.
It's about blowing up things and setting things on fire.
Yes.
It's about stabbing people in the neck and ripping out their throats.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything.
It's a Patrick Swayze Christmas.
It's everything you want.
Oof. We have gotten quite a few letters.
Yeah.
About Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I have determined that this is what we're going to do.
Yes.
I've picked a handful.
Uh-huh.
We're going to read those all today.
Yes.
Some of them are a little long, so buckle in.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to save the Nightingale letters...
for a whole other episode.
...for when you come back. Because yes. The Nightingale... kind of came and went quickly.
Yes.
But it stirred up a controversy.
Definitely.
While it was in theaters.
Yes.
For, you know, for good reason.
Absolutely.
And so, but here goes with the Once Upon a Time.
And after this,
letters.
We are never talking about this again.
Yeah, yeah. After today, we're done with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in terms of discussion.
You are entitled to all the theories and opinions that you want, but we're not talking about them on the show anymore.
Shoddy writes back.
Yes.
After we read Guy Branum's letter.
Uh-huh.
Uh, She disagrees.
She yes. You could say that.
Here's the main part. I know Mr. Branham is an ally, but his apology for the steady torrent of misogyny against women from Mr. Tarantino's 30-year career was that the director was simply commenting on misogyny itself. Poppycock! Now, Shoddy, points to you, because you're the first person in 9 years of a podcast, of this podcast, to use the word poppycock in a letter, and I really appreciate it.
It's very Vita and or Virginia of you.
She continues, I enjoy Mr. Tarantino's movies because as a minority, it is my evolutionary imperative to consume popular art while overlooking the myriad of problematic decisions made by heterosexual white men in charge. But don't tell me a movie that ends with three spoiled white guys high-fiving each other after having brutally murdered two women is ironic, while Margot Robbie has to participate in the scene through the intercom. And there you have it. Thank you, Shoddy.
Yes, we appreciate it.
And I'll say, after I read the rest of them, I'll say what I think.
Okay.
About the all the reads on yes. this film, because there are so many. Julius. This is the long one. Maybe I need my glasses. I do need my glasses.
Put on your cheaters, Grandpa.
So much text.
You know how to make your screen bigger, right? Or your font.
Don't confuse me right now.
Okay, fine. Sorry.
Hey, guys, I honestly don't get the appeal of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. The first 100 minutes was a movie without drive and with little purpose beyond nostalgia. Tarantino created a hangout movie designed to be a portrait yearning for a lost time in Hollywood, but made of characters with whom I either did not get to know, Sharon Tate, or did not want to know, Cliff and Leo. There is little insight into this time period, except maybe removing the rose-tinted glasses of old Hollywood stars and painting Leo's character as a toxic drunkard and Cliff as a wife-killer, characterizations usually reserved for gossipy tell-alls like Hollywood Babylon and tabloids rather than buddy comedies. Worse, I don't like Leonardo DiCaprio as an actor.
Oh.
I don't think he disappears into his roles at all, and I've never been a big fan of his personas on or off screen.
Ooh.
So here I'm being forced to hang out with Leo, whom I already don't like very much, play acting as a fictitious star in a fantasy of a setting that I don't really care much about. 1968, 1969 Hollywood is a period of change where the studio system was trying out new things, and smaller directors and producers were having it out with the studios. There was political unrest and upheaval in the air, but the closest we see of it is the Manson family. It's comedically unaware that Vietnam is happening outside its doors and even praises the top 20 propaganda show, the FBI. Instead, we're sitting around with has-been actors and a-hole wife-killing stuntmen basking in the old-time values and pondering what it's like to say goodbye. It's not entertaining or fun. It's just dull. It smells like gross, dirty feet. And I wish they would just move on and get to the real change. I am, yeah. About halfway through the movie, I thought, do the feet all have to be the kind that have walked down Hollywood Boulevard without shoes? Is that necessary? I guess it is. I suppose it's necessary. It is 1969 after all. He continues, 100 minutes deep and 6 months later, that real change happens, and we're given a fantasy recreation of the night that the Manson family killed Sharon Tate and what it would take to save her. QT documents a blow-by-blow assessment of the night leading to a brutal murder of the Manson girls who in real life brutally murdered Sharon Tate. Tate, in the first 100 minutes, came to represent the blissful success dreams of the 1960s, while the Mansons represented the upheaval of the impoverished underbelly of that dream. This is a snore of a dichotomy, but let's roll with it. In the violent finale, where Cliff and Leo kill the Manson clan, is Tate supposed to be Tate or a symbol? And is the killing of the Manson clan supposed to be a revenge killing, or merely just supposed to stop the killing of the good vibes stemming from that time and place? In either case, QT treats these women like they're the big bad of a Buffy season, and QT almost presents the killing of these women as if it will completely solve the problems created by the successful murder of Sharon Tate. The brutality of the murder sequence hints at the B-movie catharsis of Inglourious Basterds and the murder of Hitler, Rather than killing Manson slash Hitler, QT all but ignores Charles Manson and the majority of his clan. After dispatching these few women, Charlie is still at Spawn Ranch with another 20 brainwashed clan members set to kill again. Is QT really blaming the women and the women alone for the murder of Sharon Tate? Why not also give us vengeance upon Manson? Why not go the full nine and kill Manson? By using an extreme level of personal violence, QT is recreating the violence the Manson family engaged in. In my audience, people were hooting and laughing at the telephone face smash and the blowtorch burning. And yet, I felt a longing that they didn't kill Manson. That we saw this violence enacted upon brainwashed women, but Manson lived on and could order a different killing seemed unjust in a way that QT wasn't intending. And if they were mere symbols of the incoming change, and their death was meant to stop the change, then they didn't really accomplish that task either. After this fantasy, QT reminds us that murdering the women in this movie solved nothing. In the denouement, the final scene is like an ascension into heaven, for Leo to be one with the spirit of Sharon Tate. It's the one scene I liked, because it reminded me of Sharon Tate's actual fate in a sensitive way. The end result is a movie where I was bored for 130 minutes, annoyed for 20, and pleased by 2.
Wow.
And hang on. Here's another one. From Luca. Once upon a time, finally got released in Switzerland this weekend, and I went with my mom, who had 11 years ago showed me Pulp Fiction, and it was that experience which really turned me into a movie fan. Also the first film I saw in English. So I'm as biased as one could be when it comes to QT movies. I loved this newest movie throughout the screening, but some of your concerns really made me rethink the entire thing. For me, QT shows his reluctance to change with the times. Maybe it's a good thing he's only done a handful of films throughout his career. I liked the ending because I didn't see it coming, and it sort of played to the fairy tale aspects of the movie. The violence against the women didn't impact me after the camera holds for 5 seconds on Tex's balls being chewed by the dog, after which I couldn't take anything seriously in the fight. It felt juvenile and prepared me for the rest that was to come. Even though you two are absolutely right, I just didn't notice it in the moment. This was the best and nuanced discussion of the film I have heard. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, Luca.
Luca, you're right.
We win.
Yes. Dalen says, I found the film to be much of what you both said, Tarantino going through some sort of midlife crisis, splashing it all over movie screens across America. He also seems to focus heavily on the criticisms he's gotten for his films and his fandoms in the past, putting them all into a blender, including spaghetti westerns, feet, and poorly written female leads, produced a beautifully made middle finger to anyone that doubts his skills. And though I admire his efforts, it sure was an exercise in patience and frustration. Kelsey says, I just want to say that I have also seen those Tate crime scene photos.
The ones you mentioned,
The ones I talked about. And I relished the ending. It is 1,000% the ending that Susan Atkins really deserved. JD, this is the last one, said, I really like this discussion of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I had similar concerns with both the text of the film and the way my audience reacted. And I haven't seen many reviewers explore that aspect of the film. Yeah, once again, I saw it so early in the morning at one of those round-the-clock screenings that my audience had like 5 people in it, and no one was laughing or cheering or anything like that at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it with mostly press folks, so it would be interesting to like go to one of those screenings at the New Beverly, you know,
right?
If they aren't all sold out.
And there's the final.
Oh, okay.
Missed one. This is from Robert. I saw it on its opening night in Australia. I consider myself a fan of Tarantino's work, with the exception of Death Proof.
Huh.
And eagerly awaited this latest, so it was ultimately underwhelming to find that I didn't love it as much as some of his earlier films. For me, the biggest issue is the film as a whole. Individual scenes are great. The Julia Butters, Leonardo DiCaprio scene is among my favorite of the year. But as a whole, I left my screening thinking, what was that even about? How would I describe that to someone? Having lived in Australia all my life, the experience of seeing Margot Robbie in this film is likely very different to audiences in the Northern Hemisphere who don't share my context. Less than a decade ago, she was starring on Neighbors. Well, who wasn't?
It's the law.
You got, Neighbors is like Law and Order in Australia. Like, literally every... I think every human being in Australia is on Neighbors at some point in their life. Like, no matter what they do for a living. Oh, you're a librarian? Well, you get to be on Neighbors for 2 weeks. This is your... It's your turn.
Your number came up in the national lottery.
And I feel like I get to say this because I spent 6 months watching that show in London in 1989 at its height, the Charlene and Scott wedding, the whole everything, right? And
was that
3 years behind.
Is that the Kylie and Jason period? Or?
Yeah, that was Charlene. That's Charlene
and
Scott.
Oh, that was okay.
How come you don't know these things?
Because I've never seen a second of Neighbors. Well, it's... How would I have?
I'll tell you something about Neighbors. One of the most boring TV programs you'll ever see. So boring. Like, American soap operas back in the day, in the 80s, were like full of just glamour and sex and intrigue. And this was about just this family that lives on this block. And, you know, some bad things would happen sometimes, but like, absolutely a snooze.
The Jean Dielman of soap operas.
A little bit. But boy, everyone was hooked. Everyone was hooked on that show. I'd watch it every day.
And it's still on, right?
I don't know.
Right. Well, anyway, Margot Robbie was on.
I would watch that show every day. Okay, so anyway. So Robert, what I'd like to ask you is when were you on Neighbors? Or is it not yet your turn? Less than a decade ago, she was starring on Neighbors, a long-running Australian soap opera that continues to this day. See, if I'd gotten to the end of the sentence,
sorry,
we would have had the answer to my question. But I interrupted me.
You did.
Yeah. To see where she was come from to starring in a Tarantino film made me feel like I wasn't watching Sharon Tate, enjoying her success in the late 1960s. But seeing the actual Margot Robbie achieve real-life stardom as a Hollywood actor in a film by a director whose name alone holds a degree of elite status held by only a few.
True.
Hadn't thought about it like that.
I could see that.
That's interesting. That's an interesting read. I also really struggled with the final acts of extreme violence committed against the women. A few nights before seeing Once Upon a Time, I finally got around to watching Charlie Says. After being turned onto it through your discussion with Guinevere Turner a while back.
Cool.
Prior to watching either film, my knowledge of Manson extended as far as his pop culture status in South Park and the incongruity of Marilyn Manson, combining the beauty of Monroe with the ugliness of him. Seeing Charlie Says made me empathize with the women who were abused to the extent that they were willing to kill for a madman. Once Upon a Time doesn't establish the Manson women as monsters, deserving the fate that befalls them. Wait. The sentence he wrote reads, Once Upon a Time doesn't establish the Manson women as monsters, deserving the fate that befalls them. For viewers who haven't seen the way Charlie Says humanizes the women, I can see why the extreme violence at the end of Once Upon a Time is pleasurable in the same way as seeing Channing Tatum have his head blown off in The Hateful Eight. But
so,
for me...
So he means does establish
I think
as monsters.
I think that's what he meant to write. But for me, I couldn't enjoy it because of the perspective that I carried. The best conclusion I can come to is that I cannot revel in the violence of real people whose actions didn't warrant it. Hitler deserved the fate he received in Inglourious Basterds. The women in Once Upon a Time didn't. I love the violence of John Wick and The Raid, but I know the casualties of those films are fictional and almost always active participants in the violence. In real life, we know the Manson women committed awful acts, but in Once Upon a Time, we don't see a buildup of violent acts committed by the women against other people to warrant being set ablaze. Overall, I think the film has some quite good parts. It is well established that Leonardo DiCaprio is a good actor. Seeing him here makes you appreciate just how good he is.
Not if you're Julius.
Had I not seen Charlie Says, it's entirely possible that I would have loved the final acts of extreme violence in the same way I have loved much of Tarantino's other extreme violence.
Well, thanks everybody for these letters. We appreciate hearing from you and getting your thoughts on this. I mean, like, say what you will about Tarantino and about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It is definitely
There are a lot of ways to look at it and a lot of ways to talk about it. And, you know, you're right. There are a lot of takes out there, and it's interesting to see what different people come away with after seeing the film.
Hey, we got a 5-star review.
Ooh.
Only one, though. Where are the rest of you?
It's a start.
Where are the rest of you?
Write us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and we will read it on the show, like we're going to read this one.
From Coconut the Cat.
Okay.
Subject line, Kevin Costner's dog voice. Short and sweet, says, the best part of my Mondays, a warm hug of a podcast.
Aww. It was a warm hug of a review, Coconut the Cat.
Because it's like 90 degrees outside. That's why.
Yeah, everything's a warm hug right now. Yeah. That was very kind. Thank you. And yes, please leave us a 5-star review. It does help people find the show.
Does it?
It does. There's a whole weird Apple algorithm about things, yeah. And part of it is number of downloads, but number of reviews and number of positive reviews helps a lot.
They're going off number of downloads. We are the tiny potato.
Well, that's why the reviews mean so much.
Okay, well, good. Well, then get on it, everybody. 5 stars. 5 stars. 5.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's it.
All right. Well, hey, everybody. Thank you for listening. Do check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Our friends Bibbs and Whitney have a ton of podcasts on...
too many, really.
The Schmoes Know, and on Patreon. Check out Cancel Too Soon.
I worry about him overworking themselves.
I always worry about that. Critically acclaimed, all the best. You know, of course, check out all the other Schmoes Know stuff as well, including the Schmoes themselves. Dennis Henin with Dennis Hensley and the Comics Canon, All Things Cozy, Sewers of Paris, Deck the Hallmark, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. Again, subscribe to this show at Apple Podcasts for free. Leave us that 5-star review or leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and Spotify, TheLounge.com, CastBox, Podbean, Google Play. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and drop us a line, linoleumpodcast@gmail.com, with questions or comments. But no more letters about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
None, zero.
We're done.
No.
We're done.
Done.
Yeah, as Dave mentioned.
If you want to do the thing.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
You can join Patreon for as little as $1 a month.
You can.
That's nice. And what you get for $1 a month is me sending you a sticker in the mail, and you get to have every day LKRX, which is a daily recommendation from me or Alonzo.
Mm-hmm.
A cultural recommendation.
Yes.
But if you are of a mind to join at the $16 level or upgrade from your current level to the $16 level, and you want that free book from Karen Tonkson, signed by Karen Tonkson, the name of the book is Why Karen Carpenter Matters, you will first email me before you do anything at dlelandwhite1964@gmail.com. State your intention, and I will manifest it into the universe.
Did we mention in all of that lengthy pitch on the top of the show, patreon.com/linoleumknife?
I don't know.
We really should have been hammering that home. So
sure.
Apologies if you were baffled.
No one ever said we were good at self-promoting.
This is true.
Which
no one ever did.
We do it. We're not very good at it.
No. We give it our best shot. So yeah, patreon.com/linoleumknife. Check that out. At whatever level you want to join at, we will have fun, cool things for you.
It'll be fun to enjoy. There'll be a lot of verbal talking.
Absolutely. And yeah, and if you haven't subscribed to us just like for this show, now would be a good time to do it, because this week, as mentioned, the Summer Super Splash, a.k.a. Summer Splash Spectacular.
You get to hear everything.
Yeah, we're giving you a free LKTV, a free Linoleum Knife and Fork, and a free Linoleum Knights.
Free. These things cost money.
Usually, but not this week.
They're free.
This week they're free, so enjoy those. As Dave mentioned at the top, I am off to Venice for the film festival, but I'll come back with stories and reviews.
You return home on Tuesday, September 3rd.
Yes.
And then we'll begin recording more shows.
We will. But until then...
See you next Tuesday, Alonzo.
No, really. Until then...
Goodbye.